Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on fear and anxiety arising during meditation. When meditation is practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the context of the Four Noble Truths brings understanding and guidance. This talk is recorded on February 16, 2017, in Clinton, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's teaching is on a sutta called the, the Sundaris, now. Remember the reference. Anyway, it's about fear arising during meditation, which is very common. And I'm not just talking about fear like terror, but any type of anxiety. And it is very common to come up during meditation at different times, whether you've been meditating for a long time or just beginning. So I'll just read the article. Fear arising during meditation, particularly Shamatha Vipassana meditation, is a subject that comes up often. When meditation is practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path and the context of the Four Noble Truths brings understanding and guidance. So that just, right here in a vague way, just relates to the First Noble Truth, that dukkha occurs, an unsatisfactory experience is going to arise, and that even means during meditation there's going to be experiences of that. The First Noble Truth is a noble truth of dukkha, which means stress or disappointment. The Buddha describes that as sickness, aging, death is stressful, separation from what is desired is stressful, association with what is loathed is stressful. And both of those can occur during meditation. When we have a very distractive mind and we start to settle down and our mind resists, that's often felt like anxiety and sometimes even fear, because it feels like we're annihilating ourselves, like we're losing ourselves. And the other aspect of that is really the other side of the same coin, is just that resistance to sitting quietly. You know, that's an association with something that we just don't want to have. And that's something that the meditation practice itself is designed to alleviate that problem as long as you stay with it. Every time you come back to the sensation of breathing, even if you're stuck in a lot of anxiety and fear and resistance, every time you do that simple part of meditation, you're diminishing that response within your conditioned mind. The second noble truth is the truth of the origination of dukkha. Again, the Buddha's words. And this is the noble truth of the origination of dukkha, the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, grasping after one thing and then another, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming, as opposed to just being mindful of your breath. And so all those things can come up during meditation. Basically, what we're experiencing is wanting what we're doing in this moment to be different than it is, even though it's our intention to sit and meditate. It really shows you how strong our own conditioned mind is. It's almost like we're fighting with ourselves, aren't we? We've made the intention to now sit quietly and be mindful of our breath, but yet our conditioned mind keeps coming up and saying, I can't do this, and it throws all types of barriers, such as fear or anxiety or worry or just boredom. Excuse me, and boredom is simply the need for a distraction right now. You know, a quiet and peaceful mind, a well-concentrated mind can't be bored because it's at peace with whatever's occurring. Clinging, desire, grasping, aversion, thirst are all aspects of craving. Wanting the people and events of life to be different than what is occurring is craving or desire. Attachment to the people and events of life to remain as they are is also craving and desire. The Buddha taught that clinging arises due to a belief in a permanent and substantial self, and that this belief arises from phenomena coming into contact with our senses, including conscious thought, which leads to discriminating thoughts of pleasure and pain, attachment and aversion. So in other words, we create identity over those things that give us pleasure and also over those things that we hope to avoid. And then we become involved in this constant struggle to chase after everything that gives us pleasure and avoid anything that might give us disappointment or even boredom. And that becomes the focus of life rather than simply being present with life as life occurs. Fear originates in clinging, especially the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates are fear, fear, perceptions, mental fabrication, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and resulting consciousness. So we first identify ourselves as this physical body is me, and it's a permanent self. Feelings, in that sense, are any type of movement in our mind or an agitated mind state. It's not just an emotional or physical sensation. It's any type of movement we're referring to as feelings. And that gives rise to perceptions, which gives rise to mental fabrications and assumptions about ourselves. Good evening. Hello. Donna, good, nice to see you.
Sorry. Again.
I'm glad you're here. I'm just starting to give the talk. And then the resulting consciousness. Now, remember that consciousness is rooted in a lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths or the true nature of reality, which means that that type of ongoing consciousness is rooted in ignorance of the true nature of self in relation to the world. Is that clear? So the reason why I'm stressing that point is consciousness is often portrayed today, especially in, you know, kind of new agey ways of looking at it, as consciousness as this, I call it consciousness with a big C, a grand consciousness, that we're all part of one great blooming type of consciousness. And maybe that's true, but that's not what we're talking about here. And even to hold on to that concept is not helpful in developing the Dhamma, because it can very easily obscure what's right in front of us. We've now created an identity as this great cosmic being. And once we do that, what's most important, which is this human life that we're living, is often obscured behind that, which is a convenient way of saying, I'm going to create this identity as this cosmic being, and now I don't have to deal with my human self. And it's a common way of escaping reality. In meditation, fear arises as the implication of the cessation of clinging becomes apparent. I bet you one class a month somebody brings up that thought or feeling that meditation does feel like annihilation. And what happens when I let go of all these self-referential views? What's going to happen to me? Well, what's going to happen to you is you have let go of all these self-referential views, and now there's just you. There's just an ongoing presence in the world. And then this is getting a little bit esoteric because we don't have the complete framework for it. At least I'm not going to talk about it all tonight. Then you see yourself simply as a point of reference. And it's not even a point of reference in time. It's simply a point of reference as to what's occurring in the world. Does that make sense? Good. Donna?
I think I apologize.
No, that's okay. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. It seems a little esoteric until we really have a full understanding of what these teachings are about, including dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates, which is really, I don't like to use the word advanced, but it takes some experience in developing concentration within the framework of the Eightfold Path to find some usefulness in the teachings such as dependent origination. But since I mentioned it, dependent origination is really what the Buddha awakened to. And it states that from ignorance, a very specific type of ignorance, through 12 observable causative links, you could even say causative actions, all manner of suffering arises. So the key understanding there is that it is ignorance that gives rise to suffering. And the teachings, the Buddha is not saying, I'm certainly not saying that as human beings we are in a general way ignorant. We're not. We've all done pretty well for millions of years in developing ourselves as human beings, developing a society, etc., political systems, all that. What the Buddha is talking about is we're just simply ignorant of these Four Noble Truths. So on his very first teaching, that's what he taught, was the Four Noble Truths. And then everything he taught for the next 45 years of his life was taught in that context. And that's so important to remember, because it's too easy to take even something like fear and start applying it outside of ourselves. Like some traditions will say, well, that those are disincarnate beings or devas that are invading your mind, and that's where your fear is coming from. There's actually Buddhist traditions that are rooted in that type of thinking, and that's something that the Buddha rejected wholeheartedly when he awakened. In fact, when you read the account of his final meditation session prior to his awakening, it was a lot of fear that came up in the Buddha, but he recognized it because he had developed a proper perspective that this is not me, this is not mine. This is just an aspect of my consciousness that's rooted in ignorance. And as these different fears arose in the Buddha during his awakening experience, he recognized them as such and simply abandoned them. He didn't. The reason I'm saying that, he didn't analyze them. He didn't try to figure out where they were coming from. He simply recognized that they are words that he often used. They're like foam on the ocean. There's nothing there. And that relates back to this article. I'm getting a little bit away from the point, but I just want to bring in those other concepts. Shamatha Vipassana meditation, abandoning the distraction of attaching one thought to the next thought through pure mindfulness of the breath, is a direct challenge to the clinging mind or conditioned thinking and the belief in anatta, that in anatta the clinging establishes. In other words, simply because it's like that saying, I think, therefore I am. Simply because I'm having self-referential thoughts, that proves that this is me. And of course, that's really the heart of the problem. We've identified ourselves with assumptions that are rooted in ignorance. And so anything that follows from that has to be another expression of that ignorance. It cannot lead to awakening. But the path that the Buddha taught directly interrupts that type of thinking. And meditation is a direct experience of interrupting conditioned thinking. Lost my spot. I'll go back to the beginning of that. Shamatha Vipassana meditation, abandoning the distraction of attaching one thought to the next through pure mindfulness of the breath, is a direct challenge to the clinging mind and the belief in anatta clinging establishes. Clinging to form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and discursive thoughts establishes a belief that what is clinging is in fact the self. That relates to the five clinging aggregates. Reacting to fear further establishes clinging. Fear then is a useful tool to continue the deluded belief in anatta. Again, that's another way of saying that we create this fear ourselves to justify our resistance to meditation, to developing concentration, and diminishing this thing called anatta, this thing that is, in a sense, a false self, but we have such a strong belief in it that we have a hard time letting go of that. It's really all we think we are. But again, using that word anatta, that's what the Buddha meant by it. What you think of yourself is not a self, it's anatta. Let go of those beliefs, let go of those views. And there's a very specific way of doing that, and that's what the Eightfold Path is for. When the Buddha awakened, he understood the common human problem of conditioned thinking. And we were just as conditioned then as we are now. And he sat for another 2 weeks after his awakening experience, trying to decide if it was worth teaching what he knew, and if there was a way of teaching this that could pierce the common human problem of conditioned thinking. And in consideration, that's when he developed the Eightfold Path, and that's the primary reason why he taught it. A way of recognizing and abandoning our own conditioned thinking so that we can enter a space where we are simply a reference point. We're simply present with our life as life occurs without any reaction in our minds. Anatta, the perception of a permanent, substantial, and sustainable self, experiences fear when impermanent events, but not recognized as impermanent, when impermanent events occur that would bring disappointment, disenchantment, or any manner of suffering. Furthermore, anatta clings tenaciously to the deluded belief that each thought must be a vehicle for itself. In other words, every thought that anatta has, the five clinging aggregates has, a self-referential ego self has, is a self-referential thought. Every thought that occurs must have an aspect of anatta in it. And a way of describing that would be looking at a forest and picking and choosing what trees you find is most agreeable. Because what you're saying is, I like the oak, but I don't like pine trees. You're creating an identity to those trees. And again, this is kind of a silly example, but if you find yourself in a pine forest, you're not going to be very happy. You won't see it as beautiful because you create an identity of what you like about trees. But we do that with everything. That's really an innocuous. But anything that we identify that way, we're creating a self that is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering because we've now objectified this belief in a self further from reality. In other words, now I've made the tree who I am, and that trees must be different than they are, rather than trees are just trees, and everything is just what it is. This is touching on the kind of the Zen school, but I don't mean that, because there's much more to it than that. When the Buddha teaches the three linked characteristics of delusion, these are anatta, anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not-self characteristic, and resulting dukkha, it is precisely this process he is describing. In other words, we live in an impermanent environment. Everything in the universe, everything in all creation, we know is impermanent, even the universe that we live in. Scientists have shown that at one point it's just going to be gone, and us along with it. But in this ever-changing environment, we try to establish a permanent self wherever we find ourselves, and that cannot be done. And ultimately, that understanding, the great wisdom that's developed through the Eightfold Path, is the understanding that even my thoughts about myself are impermanent thoughts. They're always changing. And when I'm attaching them to other ever-changing events and trying to create a permanent self by that, you can see the insanity almost that's involved in that. And again, what's the answer? It's the Eightfold Path to recognize who we are in relation to this impermanent self, and to cease creating self-referential views. And that's where, again, that's where fear starts arising in meditation or anxiety. What's going to become of me when I let go of all these views? Don't I need these views to live in the world? And the answer is no. We feel that we need, many people feel we need the motivation of stress to keep us going. And of course, that's really the problem, isn't it? It's that stress itself that is creating confusion, delusion, and suffering in our minds. When we fully understand the nature of impermanence in relation to who we are at any point in time, everything, all that stress falls away. When Kundana first heard, Kundana was one of the people that the Buddha presented his first teaching to. There were five of his friends that he had been wandering around northern India with for the prior 6 years. Kundana heard this very simple explanation of the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. And he said, I think I have it. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha says, I always use this word. He didn't really use it, but the Buddha said, bingo, you got it. He didn't, I don't think it was bingo back then. What he was saying, what Kundana was saying, and it sounds almost too simple to have any usefulness, but what he understood at a deep and penetrating level, that it was his own conditioned thoughts that are impermanent and subject to cessation. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And so he will no longer attach himself to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. And that really is the ultimate goal of the Dhamma, to recognize the impermanence of our all of the thoughts that we use to establish ourselves in relation to the world are all based on impermanence, and those thoughts themselves are impermanent. And one of the things that as we deepen our concentration we can recognize very readily is the impermanence of our thoughts. As we deepen our concentration, even just a little bit, we can recognize how one thought is just as impermanent as the next thought. And a peaceful mind is no longer attached to one thought following another thought. Another way of saying that is now our minds are simply, and we have to use this word in a few different ways, now our minds are simply perceiving life as life occurs without any reaction. And of course, we will do the things that are necessary. A good example that I often use when people say, well, what happens when I let go of all these self-referential views? Well, you're likely to become one of the most effective human beings that ever occurred, that ever lived. Why do I say that? Because that's exactly what the Buddha did. He awakened. He no longer had any self-referential views. And he lived what I feel is the most important and effective life of any human being, because he was freed of all that conditioned thinking. And when you read the accounts, some of the, especially the later developed Buddhist schools, give almost superhuman qualities to the Buddha, especially as far as almost clairvoyant. He was able to read people's minds because he was able to hear somebody say something, and often it was just to look at them. And he immediately understood how to present the Dhamma to them in a useful and effective way, and many of those people awakened on the spot. And so it said that he could read people's minds, but that's not really what it was. He was just so present, so mindfully present with other people, he knew exactly what was occurring with them. And another way that he knew that because he knew himself so well. He knew his own mind so well. And as I think some of you might have even experienced this, that you have a much deeper understanding of other people because now your mind is more calm and at peace, and you understand yourself that much more. Is that true? Yeah. And even if it's just a little bit, almost too imperceptible to notice, we build on that. And we get to a very profound state where we simply understand what's occurring without any reaction. And imagine having that quality of mind in the world today with what's going on. And that's possible. When the Buddha teaches, I'm going back again, that when the Buddha teaches the three linked characteristics of delusion are impermanent, not self, and dukkha, suffering, it is precisely this process he is describing. The Buddha taught that what is perceived as a self arising from clinging is in fact not a self. This does not imply in any way that there is no self, only that the common problem of dukkha originates in an ignorant view of what constitutes a self. The reason why I say that is many of the later developed schools, especially the Zen school that I spent many, many years in, use that word anatta in an inappropriate way to imply that there's no such thing as a self. And there's a big difference between no self and not self, isn't it? Because one refers to an environment of complete emptiness and a void. The other points to views that don't constitute a self. And so the Buddha used the word emptiness. He used that to imply that we should empty ourselves of clinging. When he described an awakened, fully mature human being, he described that human being as unbound or released from clinging. So the Buddha's teachings on emptiness are quite a bit different than the later developed teachings on emptiness, which is this grand cosmic void that we're supposed to find ourselves in. It doesn't relate to what the Buddha taught. He simply said that it's your views that you should empty yourself of. Anatta must establish itself in every thought that occurs, or fear of annihilation will arise. And that's why fear arises in meditation. As we're interrupting that conditioned response to life, that self-referential ego self, anatta, is starting to lose its own grasp on maintaining itself, and fear arises. And what do we do with it? I'm going to end with that. This is about halfway through the article, but we've gone far enough with it tonight. When fear arises and we simply come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deconditioning that conditioned response. And over time, even that anxiety of letting go of self, of losing the self, will subside. Because remember, that those self-referential views are like foam on the ocean. The next mild breeze, they're gone. There's nothing really that we're holding on to. In fact, what we're holding on to is the cause of our own confusion, delusion, and suffering. Let it all go. Come back to the sensation of breathing. Off our cushions, we have the framework of the Eightfold Path to recognize when that occurs. That's where the moral and ethical factors come in. When we find ourselves perhaps in a situation with someone and that situation is giving rise to fear, we'll often project that on the other person, won't we? And somehow try to blame that other person for how we feel. That's so prevalent today. But nobody can make us feel anything. We are in charge of what we think and what we feel at all times. If we have a reactive mind, we're going to be constantly blaming the outside world for how we feel. And it's at that point that we really, you could say that we've lost our minds, because now we have no control over our thinking. In the Vitakasanthana Sutta, which is a sutta on relaxing our thoughts, the Buddha concludes that sutta with saying, you gain the ability, meaning through the Dhamma practice, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. Isn't that remarkable? No longer reacting to life. No matter what's occurred, we can maintain control of our minds, which means we can maintain our own peace and happiness. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.